Thank you very much, Lee, for that very gracious introduction. I want to thank Lenore Ely for the invitation to be here with you today. And I want to thank my distinguished colleagues here on the dais now and also throughout the day for the opportunity to share in such wonderful conversation. It's been very high-toned and interesting. I've learned a lot. Well, when my wife first heard the first draft of my remarks, which I titled The Anxiety of Realignment, she said that everybody should be given Prozac. The message was that depressing, but that was before she heard the end of the final draft, and it includes Stan Evans' Law of Perfidy, so I think it'll be some levity. We conservatives have every right to be anxious. Our country finds itself in unknown territory. It's not that we are experiencing the crises that Lee mentioned, that we're neither in a total war nor a dire economic crisis right now. Yet 2016 has forced us to throw away basically everything that we thought we knew about electoral politics. A socialist made a credible run for the Democratic nomination, but more important, he moved the Democratic Party platform farther to the left than it had ever been. This maverick businessman and TV reality star who has not shown any loyalty to the GOP nor any loyalty to conservative principles, nevertheless finds himself at the head of the Republican Party. Whole new factions of Americans who are neither big donors nor politically connected, whole new factions of people are now entering this electoral process, and they are supercharged for change. The establishment of both parties has taken a thrashing. And if you look at the $5 billion that will be spent on this year's presidential election, millions of dollars of which are going to be spent on TV ads, they won't make a difference. Meanwhile, tweets are moving mountains. All this was unthinkable just 18 months ago. No one saw it coming. But the one thing that has not changed over this period of time, the center does not hold. Anomic forces continue to coarsen and to cleave our culture. In this exploding landscape, in this wasteland of the Kardashians, we find ourselves in an age of anxiety. Now, Lee did a good job outlining five necessary conditions for a political realignment to occur, and I'd like to offer two additional points for your consideration, one of which looks back and one of which looks forward. Looking back, we conservatives should have seen the sources of our anxiety about realignment right under our noses. There's been anxiety from the left with its open declarations of victory in the culture wars. There's been anxiety on the right with its lurch toward populism and nativism and protectionism. There's been anxiety about the conservative movement as we know it, as we celebrate it in this society, that it has been left out in the cold, that it is not influential within the GOP as it has been in the past, in the broader right. What is its place anymore? And worst of all, that the great books, the books of Russell Kirk and Friedrich von Hayek and Richard Weaver and so many others who founded our movement, those books are now being relegated to historic curios. I've even picked up anxiety among my friends about the potential realignment. A favorable realignment gives them anxious chills. That's because we've seen a favorable realignment before and with less than satisfactory results. A distinguished member of the Philadelphia Society, now deceased, Stephen Tonser, put it to me this way some 3 decades ago, back in the heyday of the Reagan era. "Mr. Whitney, do not become corrupted by the imperial city. It's where scholars go to die. As for the conservative movement," said Tonser, "well, it died when it put on a blue suit and went to Washington." That was his opinion. To his students and to previous audiences of Philadelphia Society members, Tonser's drumbeat again and again and again is, do not neglect the culture. Don't get absorbed with the power. do the necessary hard work to build up the culture. Now, Tonser's message was similar to that of the strategist Paul Weyrich, who wrote a now famous letter to conservatives in 1999 that stirred up considerable discussion on talk radio and within this society. Weyrich believed the conservatives had made a Faustian bargain. They were winning elections but losing the culture in the process. Permit me to quote from that 1999 letter. In looking at the long history of conservative politics from the defeat of Robert Taft in 1952 to the nomination of Barry Goldwater in 1964 to the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and to the majority, the election, the takeover of the Republican Party in 1994, I think it is fair to say that conservatives have learned to succeed in politics. That is, we got our team elected. But that did not result in the adoption of our agenda. The reason, I think, is that politics always exists in a larger context. And politics failed because of the collapse of the culture. In truth, I think we are caught up in a cultural collapse of historic proportions, a collapse so great that it simply overwhelms the politics. Weyrich goes on to conclude by saying, "That's why I am in the process of rethinking what it is that we, who still believe in our traditional Western Judeo-Christian culture, can and should do under the circumstances." He's quick to add, "Please don't misunderstand. I'm not quarreling with anybody who pursues politics, because it is important to pursue politics. It is important to be involved in government. But it is also important to try, as many people have, to retake the cultural institutions that have been captured by the other side." End quotation. Well, I think Tonser and Weyrich and so many others made a profoundly important argument, even more penetrating today than it was two or three decades ago. They remind us that even a good political realignment must be accompanied by an even better cultural realignment. This, if favorable political action is to stick, if our pursuit of happiness is to have real meaning. Now, my second point looks forward to a revolution that is proving to be every bit as far-reaching as the French and the Industrial Revolutions. And it's not finished. It's not going away. And we're starting to see it as a driver of realignment. We cannot even wrap our minds around this upheaval that, for convenience, we shall call the digital revolution. Every few days, I find this a stunning fact, every 2 days, the length of our conference, as much data has been produced as all the information humans produced between the cave paintings and 2003. Now, that's a fact from Alec Ross, who's a fellow at Johns Hopkins. The applications of a world coded in zeros and ones are dizzying. Driverless cars, precision agriculture, artificial intelligence, robotics, the digital transfer of entire libraries. Did you know that every 6 hours, the National Security Agency is gathering as much information as is stored in the entire Library of Congress, and that it can fit in an object that's smaller than this key fob every 6 hours? Now, ladies and gentlemen, I would think if you weren't a statist or an anti-statist before you heard that fact, you'd sure be likely to turn into one after learning it. Ross also notes that you can break the digital revolution down into two historic phases: the world's last trillion-dollar industry that arose from digital coding, and the world's next trillion-dollar industry that is coming from genetic coding. The genomic therapies that are being developed now will soon be eliminating diseases and extending our lives by 3 to 5 years. The digital revolution is breathtaking to those who have the ability to access and manipulate it, and it is heartbreaking to those who do not. While many industries and communities are making the digital pivot, not all will. Those that successfully pivot will embrace the digital revolution and will prosper. Those that don't will become slums of despair. The people in these slums will be susceptible to radicalization by the far left and the far right. The truck drivers, the janitors, the people who fold the clothes, the hotel maids, if they are not part of the digital revolution, they might become become part of a counter-revolution and tear down what they cannot build up. Let me illustrate what is happening. This is also, to me, a shocking anecdote. There's a businessman in China who's employed over 100 or 1 million people. He has these factories with these long assembly lines, and he made the digital pivot and brought in robots to work the assembly line. As he said, robots don't ask for raises, they don't steal from the company, they don't get sick, they don't get tired, they work 24/7 with nary an HR issue. The robots were so successful that this factory owner could let go of the million workers he did have, 600,000 workers. Well, ladies and gentlemen, scaled to America, that could be the source of a lot of realignment. As my friend Joe Lehman, who's the president of the Mackinac Center, likes to say, here come the robots, and the pitchforks aren't far behind. Now, when thinking about the consequences of the digital revolution, it's not so much a failure of understanding that I fear, it's a failure of imagination. To visualize what a digital dystopia might look like, I'd recommend you reread Kurt Vonnegut's 1952 novel called Player Piano. It tries to describe a world in which physical labor is eliminated, a world in which people whose vocation it is to work with their hands are left out in the cold. In conclusion, while there is a lot of anxiety about realignment, it would not hurt to follow the lead of Russell Kirk at this point and let a little cheerfulness break in. In the first place, we conservatives should not look upon realignment passively as if we are just victims powerless to bring about and shape the change. We're intentional, we're volitional. I mean, I'm looking at the people in this room who are doing so much. I'm looking at my friend Winston Elliott, who's doing great things at the Imaginative Conservative. I see Annette Kirk, who's doing great things to forward the legacy of a great, towering conservative figure at the Russell Kirk Center. I'm looking at Glenn Arbery, who's doing so much at Wyoming Catholic College. And I'm thinking of Brad Berzer, whose great book on Russell Kirk we're going to be celebrating later this evening. Each of these men and women, each in his or her own way, is anchoring their good work to the permanent things. They are a contradiction to their age. They are making a difference. They and so many of you are tending to the cultural realignment that must occur for a favorable political realignment to come about. And as for conservatives who are attached to the Republican brand, whatever the status of the party at the national level in 2016, at the local and state levels, the GOP is fielding outstanding men and women who are fiscally conservative, problem solvers. They're winning many of the elections in local and state races. We must remain on the lookout and cultivate these outstanding young leaders. So in a spirit of cheerfulness, I conclude with the words of Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America, which has already been quoted several times today, but de Tocqueville wrote, "A new political science is needed for a world altogether new. To instruct democracy, to reanimate its beliefs, to purify its mores, to moderate its movements, to adapt its government, and to modify it according to circumstances and men, such is the first duty imposed on those who would guide society in our day." Well, looking out at you, I see a lot of wonderful guides to our society, and that gives me hope.